Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 265, Legal Tender and the Credit Clearing Function. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, July 6th, 2011. In this installment of the podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that I recorded last week with Thomas H. Greco, Jr. He is the author of a book called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Reading from the book, Thomas H. Greco, Jr. is a leading authority on free market approaches to monetary and financial innovation, including cashless exchange systems. A former engineer, entrepreneur, and college professor, he is a sought-after advisor and speaker at conferences around the world. His website, www.reinventingmoney.com, and associated blogs constitute a unique resource. He can be reached via his website. Actually, I had trouble reaching him via his website, so I would like to thank Ian B. for facilitating that initial contact between me and Thomas Greco. I would also like to thank Alex P. and Tom C. They both clicked on the PayPal donate button and sent some funds my way to help out with the production of the podcast, and Jim D., who sent a paper check. If you'd like to send a paper check or anything else, really, anything legal and within reason, you can send it to KMO, the Eco Village Training Center, Post Office Box 90, Summertown, Tennessee, 38483. Again, that's Post Office Box 90, Summertown, Tennessee, 38483. That is the address to which Jason P. sent a memory stick all the way from Cornwall, England. On the memory stick was the new documentary by Adam Curtis. It's called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. I've only seen the first two installments. I'm looking forward to the rest. It is a documentary from the documentary filmmaker who created The Century of the Self. And this most recent documentary series is about the idea that computer networks can link up human beings in such a way that a spontaneous societal will emerges, a spontaneous new order comes into being and renders government and traditional political activities outmoded. And Adam Curtis is not necessarily a supporter or propagandist for this idea. He, in fact, is looking at it critically. So the series seems like it will provide the seed for many a future conversation, and thanks again to Jason P. for sending that documentary series to me on a memory stick. Thanks also to Alex P., Tom C., and Jim D. for their very, very generous support of the Sea Realm podcast. The music that you will hear this week came to me via Shen of Tibet to Timbuktu. The music is by Yuki Taniguchi, and it is a collection of mantras. I've pulled out a very short selection because I don't have much time in this week's episode, mainly because there is a teaser for a future episode of the Sea Realm podcast, an interview with Tony Wright. He has a Kickstarter fundraising campaign going on right now, so I'm going to play about a 10-minute teaser interview with Tony Wright at the end of this episode. But up first is my conversation with Thomas H. Greco, Jr. So here we go.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Sea stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm joined by Skype from Chiang Mai, Thailand, by Thomas H. Greco. He is the author of The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Thomas Greco, welcome to the Sea Realm podcast.
Glad to be with you.
Well, I'm just looking at your book now, and in big print on the back cover, someone described your book as a sweeping view of money and a plan to democratize the economy and restore the credit commons. And credit commons is in quotation. So to start off, would you say a little bit about that phrase, credit commons?
Yeah, that's a concept that nobody else has been talking about. That's something that I started discussing 2 or 3 years ago. And what I've learned in the process of researching money and banking and the basic economic problems that we're confronted with today is that money is nothing but credit. And basically, it's our collective credit that supports every currency system in the world. So in the United States, of course, we use dollars, and we are required by law to accept dollars in payment. That's what's known as legal tender laws. And so it's our collective credit that supports the dollar, because we need to accept it. We're required by law to accept it in payment for debts that are owed to us. So the fact is that money has evolved over time. It's gone through several different stages. Initially, money was some basic commodity that people valued, and many things have been used over the years to serve the purpose of money, that is, medium of exchange. In the colonial days, tobacco served as money, hides, animal skins, bullets, sugar, salt, various commodities that were in general demand could be used as an exchange medium. And even if I didn't have any use for tobacco myself, I might accept it in payment for my goods and services, because I knew that I could use it to acquire whatever I wanted from somebody else. But, as time went on, silver and gold became the favored commodities as exchange media, because they have certain properties that make them favorable to that function. But as time went on, bankers discovered that they could issue banknotes on the basis of gold and silver deposits. So that became a symbolic representation of the commodities on deposit somewhere, kind of like a warehouse receipt. So people began to use the banknotes as exchange media. But bankers soon discovered that people didn't come for their gold or silver, that by and large most of the deposits remained in the bank. Not many people came for the gold or silver. They were using the banknotes as exchange media instead. So they figured out that they could issue more banknotes than they had gold and silver. This is known as fractional reserve banking. This isn't necessarily a bad thing if the banknotes are issued on the basis of sound collateral. In effect, banks were monetizing the value inherent in other collateral assets against these banknote loans. But, of course, this became a more obscure mechanism of creating the exchange media. And so banks could sometimes engage in less than proper procedures in creating these banknotes, creating banknotes on the basis of no collateral or inadequate collateral. So you had a lot of room for shenanigans to take place. And so this is the reason why we've gotten into difficulties, or one of the reasons why we've gotten into difficulties of late, because the sound principles of commercial banking have been pretty much put aside as banks try to maximize their profits, and as banking has become more and more concentrated in fewer hands. So basically what we have now is a credit money system, or a debt money system, to look at the other side of the balance sheet. And it's our collective credit that supports the national currency. As I put it, we give our collective credit to the banks, and then we beg them to lend some of it back to us and pay them interest for the privilege. So this is a situation which has enabled the concentration of power and the concentration of wealth in ever fewer hands. And this is the exact opposite direction that we need to go. If we want to democratize our society, we need to have a democratic economy as well as a democratic government. And democratic government has been undermined over the years as well, as money has become the be-all and the end-all, and elections can easily be bought, and politicians can easily be bought by not only those who have the money, but those who actually create the money, the banking establishment.
So the credit commons is that pool of credit which we all create collectively and lend to the banks?
Well, we basically give it to the banks, and we ask the banks to lend it back to us. The only way we can access the credit commons now is through banks, by asking a bank to give us a loan. So if you imagine the physical commons, people have little familiarity with this concept these days, but in centuries past, there was certain land that was part of the common heritage of the community, where peasants would graze their animals and collect firewood from the commons. And we still have vestiges of it. There's in Boston something called the Boston Commons, which was a non-privately owned portion of land in the city. I don't know if it still is, but it's still called the Boston Commons. Anyway, you had these commonly owned and controlled parcels of land that people generally had access to. But then in England, you had the Enclosure Acts, which enclosed the commons and put them into the hands of the nobility, and then drove people out, forced them to pay rent to the lords in order to gain access. So we've had a continual process of privatizing the commons. Every aspect of the commons has been privatized to a very high degree by this point. Well, and the most important aspect from my perspective is the credit commons, because those who control money basically control everything in the economy.
You mentioned legal tender, and in reading your book, I was moved to write down the question, what are the nature and the consequences of legal tender?
Well, the nature of legal tender, it's an attempt by government to force acceptance of a debased currency. If you go back in history, just consider the history of money in the United States, which is a major topic that I cover in my latest book, The End of Money. If you look at the history of the United States, initially we had gold and silver coins circulating as currency. That was the exchange media. And the colonies were starved for gold and silver because in our trade with Great Britain, the British were requiring payment in gold and silver, leaving the colonies with very little exchange media for business to be conducted in the Americas. So the colonies created paper money, or basically credit instruments that served as exchange media. And one of the major causes, it's said, of the Revolutionary War was the fact that Britain outlawed these colonial currencies. This caused great economic hardship. But looking at what came a little bit later, you had this lack of exchange media, and when the Revolutionary War was won and the colonies federated into the United States, they defined what the U.S. dollar would be. And at that time, you had circulating in the colonies, most of the gold and silver coins that were circulating were Spanish coins. The word dollar actually comes from the word thaler, and thaler was a very early form of coined money that originated in Germany. But anyway, the Spanish were creating these milled silver dollars. Some of these were called pieces of eight because they could be easily broken into eight bits. But during the post-Revolutionary War period, there was the question of what would be the money that would be created for use in the United States. And the United States dollar was then defined as a certain weight of silver. What they did was to take a survey of the Spanish dollars that were then in circulation, and there was some variation amongst these depending on when they were issued. Some were lighter, some were heavier, but they came up with an average amount of silver that was contained in these Spanish silver dollar coins, and decided that the silver dollars that would be minted by the United States would contain 371 1/4 grains of fine silver. So that was the original definition of the United States dollar. It was a coin that would contain that amount of silver, and that was the silver standard. Then as paper money began to be issued, denominated in silver dollar units, the government was trying to issue more money than there was silver available to back it up. During the Civil War, the government got into great difficulty because war is a very expensive proposition. And President Lincoln was trying to find ways to finance the war. He went to the New York bankers, and the bankers were willing to extend loans, but at rates of interest around 30% or more. And Lincoln was very loath to take on debt at those usurious rates of interest. So one of his cabinet members suggested that paper dollars be issued directly from the Treasury. And these became known as greenbacks because they were printed in green ink on the reverse side. There were many issues of greenback currency during the Civil War, and these were used to pay the troops and to pay the suppliers of the war materials and all the other things needed to conduct the war and run the government. Ostensibly, these paper notes were to be redeemable in specie, that is, silver or gold. But when there were such enormous issues of greenbacks that were put into circulation, there was not the possibility of redeeming them in silver or gold. So legal tender law was passed that said, if I owe you a debt, you must accept the paper just as if it were silver. So there was a legal equivalence created between the paper currency and the silver coins. There's a well-known law called Gresham's Law in economics that says bad money drives good money out of circulation. If I have the choice to pay you with silver or with debased paper currency, I'm going to pay you with the paper and hold on to the silver. So that's the good money being driven out of circulation. The whole purpose of legal tender laws is to force the acceptance of a debased currency. And in fact, Salmon P. Chase was the Treasury Secretary during the Lincoln era, and he oversaw the issuance of the greenback currency into circulation. And there was a debate at that time as to whether legal tender was required in order to force these notes to circulate. At first, Salmon P. Chase favored the greenbacks, but when he became Supreme Court Justice, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, following the Civil War, he reversed his position, and he argued that the powers of the government were unconstitutionally exceeded by making the greenbacks legal tender. He said, and I quote, "The legal tender quality is only valuable for the purposes of dishonesty," unquote. And that's my position as well. I think legal tender, as I said, is an attempt to force the circulation of a debased or inferior paper currency. And if government wants to issue paper currency, that's well and good, but they should not be able to force people to accept it. It should be subject to refusal or discounting in the marketplace according to its perceived value.
So how would that play out in a real-life situation? If people decided that they'd rather not take payment in dollars, but the dollar bill says that it is legal tender for all debts, public and private, how does that tension get resolved?
Well, that's exactly the point. It's the legal tender laws that makes the Federal Reserve note legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, who is the government to say that I have to accept a certain kind of currency or exchange medium in payment for a debt that you owe me? That's a private matter between me and you. And we should be able to decide for ourselves what an acceptable payment medium would be. Or if I did decide that I was willing to accept dollars, I should be allowed to discount the rate at which I accept those dollars. Right now, I have to accept them at face value. If the note says $10, I have to accept it in payment for a $10 debt. But I might think that that $10 note is really only worth $6. And I'd say, well, I'll give you $6 worth of goods and services for that $10 face value note. In the early days of banking in the United States, that's exactly how things worked. Each bank issued their own bank notes, and it was backed up only by the resources of that particular bank. So if you had a note drawn on the Bank of Podunk, that could only be satisfied by going to the Bank of Podunk and claiming the gold or silver that was on deposit. Only the bank was obligated to accept it at face value. You know, private parties might be willing to accept Podunk banknotes. However, they were free to discount them or refuse them entirely if they were doubtful about the solvency of that bank. And there were actually at that time catalogs that were issued periodically by private entities that sort of gave a valuation to these different banknotes of the various banks, just as we have stamp catalogs for stamp collectors or coin catalogs for coin collectors that basically give you some idea of what the market value is of those stamps or coins. Similarly, banknotes of the various banks were evaluated, and those rates were published in these different catalogs. But government wants to give itself the power to basically spend as much money as it wants without regard to tax revenues. And so they've been deficit spending almost for the entire history of the United States. And it's not only a U.S. phenomenon, it's a global phenomenon. You know, this whole central banking regime has spread around the world, and virtually every country in the world has a central bank which enjoys privileged status from its government. And you can go back and trace the history of central banking. That's a very interesting bit of history, which I also describe in my book. Going back to the Bank of England, founded in 1694, more than 300 years ago, that sort of set the pattern for central banking worldwide. Now, the emergence of the Bank of England came about in the context of another war. William III had come to power on the throne of England, and he was fighting a war against France. And, of course, as I said, war is a very expensive proposition, and monarchs and governments generally are limited in the amount of revenue that they can raise through taxation without causing great civil unrest. So William Paterson and his cohorts came to the king and they said, we will give you the money that you need to fight the war if you will give us the privilege of issuing banknotes, Bank of England notes, into circulation by lending them at interest. So you had this collusive arrangement between high finance and government. Government got to spend beyond its means, and the financiers got to create money, which they could then lend into circulation at interest. So you had born in that one act two parasitic elements on the economy. You had interest on our collective credit that the banks managed to privatize, and you had inflation, which was caused by the chronic deficit spending of the government. You know, inflation has been called a hidden tax, and it's only hidden as long as prices in the market remain relatively constant. But eventually, as the deficits get monetized, debased money goes into the economy, and the only way that sellers have to protect themselves against this legalized counterfeit is to raise their prices if they can. Now, many sellers are not in a position to raise their prices. Others that are in a competitive position to raise their prices will do so. So we're seeing that today. The U.S. government has been spending far beyond its means for a long time. And in recent years, especially since the financial meltdown of 2008, we've been running government budget deficits on the order of $1.5 trillion. These are unheard of amounts. And if you look at the debt charts over time, you can see this exponential growth in debt. And this is what's destroying our economy and our society.
Svasti prajapyah pariparayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samastah sukhino bhavantu kare varshat parjanyah prithivi sasya sharini desho yankshu bharahitah brahmanav santu nirbhayah sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah sarve bhatrani pasyantu ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhave.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO. I'm talking with Thomas H. Greco. And Thomas, something that I wanted to ask you about. You reference Carol Quigley's writing quite a bit in your book, and I'd like to just have you say some very general things about Carol Quigley and his ideas.
Well, Carol Quigley was a very influential person. He was a professor, a historian at Georgetown University, and he was a mentor of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, in his acceptance speech for the nomination as president, praised Carol Quigley as being his mentor. Carol Quigley was not only a historian and a professor, he was also an advisor to presidents in many different agencies of government. And in 1966, he wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. And it's fairly obscure book, but it deserves a great deal of attention. Because in that book, Carol Quigley basically outlined what the elite plan was. And the elite plan was to create a new financial order, a new world order, if you will. let me see, I have the quote here. He said, "The powers of financial capitalism had a far-reaching plan. Nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. Their secret is that they had annexed from governments, monarchies, and republics the power to create the world's money." And that, in a nutshell, tells the reality of our current situation. And so that's the point of departure that we need to take in looking at how to remedy the situation. Economists and politicians like to talk about the free market, but you had John Michael Greer on your program a while back, and I listened to that interview, and I think he's exactly correct that there are no free markets. You know, all the markets are controlled and manipulated by a few large players, and that becomes even more so in the realm of money and banking. You have companies like Goldman Sachs and other investment banks that basically control everything. If you look at who's in power in the government, the last two Treasury secretaries have been from Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs people are all over in the Federal Reserve and in the various branches of government that have to do with money and finance. So, you know, it's pretty clear to me who's running the political show. But basically, capitalists hate competition. They hate free markets. They try to dominate markets, both markets for their products and markets for the inputs to their productive process. And they drive out competition in any way they can.
I think, as I understood John Michael Greer's point, he was saying there is no such thing as a free market because in an unregulated market, the most powerful and dominant players in that market are the ones who control it. And so what capitalists mean when they talk about free markets really is an unregulated market where they themselves can be the controlling influence.
That raises an interesting question about regulation. Who is the regulator and what is the basis for regulation? One of the blind spots that even libertarians have is the corporate charter. The corporate charter is a privilege granted by a government entity. And most of the players in the economy are corporate entities. So they have their existence based on a concession from the government. And so we also need to look at the power of corporations. That's where the rules need to be strictly adhered to, and the rules need to be written in a certain way that corporations cannot become dominant in markets. You know, we have things like the Federal Trade Commission and the Securities and Exchange Commission and all of these other commissions that were set up during the 1930s in an attempt to control corporate power and to deal with the robber barons, as they were called 100 years ago, and to limit the power of corporations to drive out competition. But, you know, ultimately these regulatory agencies become captive of the industries that they're supposed to regulate. So the question is, what is an effective control mechanism? What is an effective regulatory mechanism that will prevent this? Can we continue to allow corporate charter? Can we continue to allow large players to get ever larger and dominate markets? I don't know the answer to that one, but I think it requires a serious look. But back to the money problem, I think this is the fundamental problem. I talk about the growth imperative in my book, and this is something that nobody else really is talking about other than myself. And basically, the problem is that when money is created by banks on the basis of interest-bearing loans, there is put into place a positive feedback mechanism. If you go to a bank and you borrow, let's say, $100,000 at 10% interest, the way the bank creates the money is by making two bookkeeping entries. It will take your signed mortgage note, $100,000, as an asset on their balance sheet, and they will create an offsetting liability of $100,000, which will be a deposit to your account. So on the one side, on the asset side, there's your bank note, and on the other side, there's a new deposit that's been created on the basis of that debt. Now, if interest accompanies this note, then in a year's time, you're going to owe the bank $110,000. But only $100,000 were created to begin with. If you're going to be successful in repaying your note at the end of a year, you're going to have to acquire that extra $10,000 from market activities. If you're successful in acquiring the $110,000 that you owe, that means somebody else who borrowed money at the circulation is going to come up short. So the basic point is that there's never enough money in existence in order for all debtors to repay what they owe to the banks, plus the interest that's accrued. So you have this chronic scarcity of money in the productive sector. You have debtors scrambling, trying to avoid defaulting on their loans. The debt grows simply with the passage of time, and it grows exponentially. So the amount of debt owed becomes ever greater in absolute terms as time goes on. Well, this forces everybody who's competing in the economy to try to increase their sales, increase their profits as a way of servicing their debt. This is what has driven this economic expansion over the last 300 or 400 years. Now, to some extent, the economic expansion has been beneficial, but it has also resulted in tremendous despoliation of the environment and destruction of the social fabric. So we have in the economy this growth imperative that is basically the result of creating money on the basis of interest-bearing debt. What we need to do is to transcend that growth imperative. The way I look at it is we're going through a metamorphic stage in civilizational development, similar to the change from the caterpillar to the butterfly. If you look at the behavior of the caterpillar behavior is very destructive. If you have an infestation of caterpillars in your garden, they can defoliate your plants almost overnight. So the caterpillar, its function is to eat and to grow and to eat and to grow. But eventually it reaches the point where that growth must stop. There's something in the program that says you've grown enough, it's time to stop, and now there's a period of quiescence, which is the chrysalis stage. The skin of the caterpillar hardens into a shell, and the caterpillar body begins to disintegrate within the shell. So all of those accumulated nutrients in the caterpillar body now become available to what are called imaginal cells. The imaginal cells are the cells of the emergent butterfly that have been in the caterpillar body from the beginning. But during the larval stage or the caterpillar stage, these cells were dormant, not active. But once the caterpillar body begins to break down in the chrysalis, then these imaginal cells begin to become active. They multiply and they form into the organs of the new butterfly. And when that process is complete, the butterfly emerges from the shell. And if you look at the butterfly behavior, it's entirely different from the caterpillar behavior. The butterfly doesn't eat plants. It pollinates flowers. It collects nectar from the flowers. That's what it lives on. And in the process of collecting nectar, it helps to pollinate those plants. So it becomes a symbiotic relationship between the butterfly and the environment. And I think that's what we're going through in civilization today. You know, 30 years ago, Alvin Toffler wrote a book called The Third Wave, where he marked three waves of civilizational change. The first wave was the agricultural civilization, where people began to settle into communities and began to grow food and produce surplus food. The second wave was the industrial era, where we began to use our tools to create all kinds of labor-saving machinery and mechanisms and produce a plethora of consumer goods. And he pointed to the third wave as a new wave that we're going through in the current period, which was a wave to a new civilization, what I call the butterfly civilization or the butterfly society. It has characteristics that make it referred to by some as the information age. And if you look at what's happening today, we have a new era of shared information. Information is something that I can give away and still have myself. So it's different from material things. If I give you my coat, then I no longer have the coat. But if I share information with you, we both have the information, and we can act on it and benefit from it. So I think we're going through this metamorphic process into the butterfly society, which I think is going to be a much happier society, much more peaceful, with solving many of the chronic problems that humanity has faced. You know, I first started out on my quest more than 30 years ago to determine why humanity faces these chronic difficulties of recurrent wars, starvation amidst plenty, violence and crime. Why do these things keep recurring? And I quickly discovered that it was the systems of our society that basically caused the perpetuation of these problems. As I said, this growth imperative, to me, is the driver of all of this. The enabler has been the abundance of cheap fossil fuels that has made it possible for us to multiply our efforts using oil and gas and coal and other fossil fuels that provide tremendous amounts of energy to us. The break, of course, on this whole process is nature. On a finite planet, growth can only continue up to a point, and it either has to level off or we face catastrophic collapse. And if you look at insect populations or animal populations, for example, you can see examples of exponential growth in the population of insects or animals, and at some point a catastrophic drop-off as the population exceeds the food supply. Now, we're facing a multidimensional crisis in our world today. It's environmental, it's social, we face resource depletion. A lot of things are coming together at one time. This is the program that says stop. So we have to go to a no-growth society. We have to have an economy that emphasizes quality of life rather than quantity of consumption. And everything in this economy now, the consumer society, is geared to produce more and more stuff, create more and more waste, and we have things like planned obsolescence and a need for companies to dominate markets. So we have to get beyond that to a steady state economy. And the only way to do that is to reclaim the credit commons and create exchange media that are not based on creating money at compound interest.
Well, let me ask you about the title of your book, because your last answer to my question seems to lead into that. Your book is called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. You've talked a little bit about your vision of the future of civilization as analogous to the butterfly, where it's past its really consumptive, destructive stage. Talk about the end of money.
Well, when I talk about the end of money, I'm quite serious about that. I mean it in a couple of different ways. First of all, it's the end of political money. You know, every country around the world has a central bank. Sometimes those banks are private. Sometimes they're nominally owned by the government. But it's basically the financial elite that runs the central bank. And you have the currency of the central bank in a privileged position because of legal tender laws. We're reaching a point where political money is at the end of its tether. People are not going to tolerate it any longer. We are creating new forms of exchange that do not require the use of political money, and political money will be eschewed despite legal tender laws. The second thing is that we think of money as a thing. The banknotes that you carry in your pocket. But most of the money is actually in the form of bank deposits, in checking accounts, in one bank or another. And it comes into existence, as I said, by banks making loans. And really, the Federal Reserve notes that you carry in your pocket are only obtained by drawing against a bank account. Someone has to draw against a bank account deposits that were originally created on the basis of debt, a loan made by a bank. So money is no longer substantial. It's really just an accounting system, debits and credits. And I talk about the credit clearing process. When you think about what banks do, the primary function of a bank is to provide a credit clearing function. Let's say you work for an employer who deposits your salary directly to your bank account. Now, maybe you get paid once a month. So at the end of each month, your employer tells the bank, add a certain number to so-and-so's bank account. And then you take your checkbook and your debit card and you go shopping. And when you buy something, that results in a debit to your account. So the bank is really just keeping track of debits and credits. The other thing that bank does is to make loans, as I said, creating the money in the first place. But we can do the debit and credit process for ourselves. You know, we can do this credit clearing process outside of banks without using any political currency. And in fact, there's plenty of precedent for this. It's actually being done today. One of the best examples of a cooperative credit clearing process is the Vir Bank in Switzerland. That's W-I-R. The Vir Bank, then called the Vir Cooperative Circle, Cooperative Business Circle, was created in 1934 by the small and medium-sized businesses in Switzerland. This was during the Great Depression, where in Switzerland, as in the United States, there was an inadequate supply of official money in circulation. So these business people came together to try to figure out how they could continue to do business with one another, even though they didn't have any money or not enough money. And they came up with this credit clearing process. By organizing themselves into this trading circle, they decided that they could simply trade as usual, buy and sell with one another, but instead of demanding Swiss francs in payment, they would simply keep a record of debits and credits. You're a member of the circle. When you buy something, your account is debited. When you sell something, your account is credited. So your account fluctuates up and down, ostensibly fluctuating around zero. Sometimes it'll be positive, sometimes it'll be negative. So this is the credit clearing process. And basically, in effect, what we're doing is creating our own internal currency by associating in these credit clearing circles. Because some members are allowed to buy before they sell. That means their account balance can be negative. This is basically the money supply within the circle. The total sum of all negative balances or positive balances, if you want to look at that side of it, represents the money supply within the credit clearing circle. So this Vir credit clearing circle has been in operation now for more than 75 years, still going strong. It has about 60,000 business members throughout the country of Switzerland, and they transact about $2 billion worth of goods and service exchanges every year. Secondly, we have the commercial trade exchanges, erroneously called barter exchanges. They do the same thing. These are for-profit businesses that solicit membership from the business community. So if I operate, let's say, a trade exchange in my hometown of Tucson, I would recruit restaurants and newspapers and radio stations and dry goods suppliers and various kinds of retail establishments and other businesses to participate in this trade exchange. in which we would simply keep a record of debits and credits, allowing some members to have this line of credit or overdraft privilege, which means that they could have a negative balance. There are dozens, scores of these trade exchanges in operation all over the world. You have IMS, Barter Card International, Trade Source in Phoenix. You have just dozens of these operating in different communities around the world. And these trade exchanges collectively enable their members to transact tens of billions of dollars worth of trading without the use of cash, without the use of official government money, without the help of any bank. So this is the future that that I see that is going to become much larger factor in the economy worldwide as time goes on.
Well, your book tells a very complicated story. There are many parts that we could spend a lot more time developing a more nuanced understanding of in our conversation, but we don't have time for that in this particular conversation. So, Thomas H. Greco, I thank you very much for participating on the CROM podcast, and I'd like to have you back sometime to dig deeper into these same topics.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
On the CROM podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back to its old dimensions.
That was Thomas H. Greco, Jr. He's the author of The End of Money and The Future of Civilization. I hope to have him back on the podcast in the future. And on next week's show, I will be playing a conversation that I just recorded with Tony Wright. And I've got Tony Wright here. Tony, welcome to the CROM podcast.
Hi, Camo. How are you?
I am well. You and I have been on the phone for the better part of an hour, actually a little more, and we've had a wide-ranging discussion, which the CREALM audience will have the opportunity to hear in a couple of weeks. What do they have in store?
Well, I hope something of great interest. Basically, I'm in the early stages of a Kickstarter launch to try and draw attention to a project I've been working on for about 20 years. The idea is to get a documentary film off the ground, exploring a kind of investigative documentary, exploring the possibility that behind all the symptoms we see that we are all worried about and that I'm sure you have guests on about, behind all that, there's a common cause. And that's that the idea is there something wrong with our neural system? Has it degenerated? That's my basic proposal. I'm trying to sort of put in modern language what the ancient tradition said with one voice, that we'd slid slowly into a degenerative state, all-encompassing delusion, and our behavior is becoming increasingly primitive. So, yeah, we've got a project just launching at the minute, and it involves filmmaker David Malone. He's got a reputation for making excellent documentaries for mainstream broadcast, and he wants to make this film. We've just got to raise, a few dollars.
What is the film?
The working title is Molecules of Madness. Quite what the final title will be, who knows? But it's the inference is that the molecular structure of our neural system's changed, and that's what's made us clinically insane.
Now, you're asking for what seems to me like quite a large sum of money with your Kickstarter campaign. Talk about the scope of your ambition here.
Yes, it is pretty big by Kickstarter standards, although I think relative to the problems we face, it's loose change, really. It's more a case of whether we can get the networking done in time. But yeah, the idea is to make a two-part documentary, one part primarily looking at our evolution in the modern context, our origins. And again, I've sort of proposed the ancient traditions were pretty damned accurate. We just misinterpret them now. They talk about naked, fruit-eating, forest-dwelling. Well, modern science talks about exactly the same thing. Primates, arboreal, forest-dwelling, fruit-eating, and so on. So looking at that, but from a slightly different perspective, and I'm saying that a key element in my proposal is our relationship with flowering plants, particularly the tropical trees, and not just the tropical trees, but in fact, their developmental environments, their sex organs, in fact. We specialized in eating plant sex organs, the fruit. And that's particularly interesting in that the developmental environment is designed to create a whole new generation. It's hormonally rich. It's designed to read the DNA very, very differently, so you end up with a complete compressed plant held in an embryonic juvenile form. That's what we specialized in eating. And the plants specialized in expanding their organs. They became colored up. It's quite a sexy thing going on there. That was our origins. So looking at that and how that must have impacted on our development, affected our endocrine system, affected our neural development. And then the other part of the equation is going to be looking at our current state of mind. And are there any clues in the modern neurological literature, the modern psychological literature, to support the ancient traditions that we are in deep, well, psychological trouble, we're deeply deluded? Is there a neurological foundation to that? So those are the kind of two parts of the documentary proposal. David's very keen to make this. I'm very keen for it to be made. Really, just to ask the question again: if there's nothing amiss here, if everything's working fine, then we look for solutions elsewhere. If there's something wrong with a state of mind, or in this case, the neurological structure that somehow facilitates our state of mind, that's got to be a place worth looking.
I agree. I hope that your Kickstarter campaign is successful, and I would encourage people whose interest has been piqued by what you just said to tune in here to the CROM podcast for the full-length discussion that we just recorded in a couple of weeks' time.
Thanks so much. Thanks now. Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Tony Wright, author of the book Left in the Dark. He's looking to make a rather high-profile and professional documentary about the ideas that he's described in his book. And you can find a link to his Kickstarter campaign in the show notes for this episode. You'll find them at kmo.livejournal.com. Before that, and for most of the hour, you heard from Thomas H. Greco Jr. I had to edit several bits from the conversation just to make it fit within this episode. One bit I've pulled out and will use on an upcoming episode in a conversation that I'll be having with Douglas Lane. Another bit I think is worth using, but I just don't have a place to use it right now. But if you'd like to hear it, send me an email. My email address is kmo@c-realm.com, and I will just attach that to the email and send it right back to you. As I say, I had to cut a bit from that interview, but Thomas Greco was rather keen that he be able to read out the names of his websites. And while I have cut that from the interview, I will have them in the show notes for this episode. But the websites are beyondmoney.net, reinventingmoney.com, and he also wanted me to mention his book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. It is available through Amazon.com, at bookstores, and in all the places where you'd normally go for books. And I will, of course, put it in the Amazon.com C-Realm bookstore. And you can find a link to that on C-Realm.com. That is the letter C, like consciousness, and then a dash, and then R-E-A-L-M.com. And for those of you who volunteer your graphic design talents and design flyers, banners, posters, anything like that for the C-Realm, the R in C-Realm is always capitalized. Next week's show, if all goes according to plan, is going to be so high profile and so mind-blowingly awesome that I dare not speak of it at this time. But if you wanted to have your sponsorship message read out in an episode that is likely to be heard by more than the usual C-Realm audience, then you might want to send something via PayPal and follow up with an email sometime in the next 4 or 5 days before next week's episode comes out. Because if all goes according to plan, it's going to be a barn burner. Check it out. Well, that is all that I have for this installment of the C-Realm podcast. Do join me again for next week's episode. That will be episode number 266. And until that time, stay well.